I'm Bob Gatenby from the Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida.
And Bob, you were talking about ways that proteins get into the nucleus.
Well, the pathways are very important in cancer research because they take information that comes to the cell membrane that are like growth factors. These are instructions to grow or to not grow or whatever it is that cells communicate with each other. These are then communicated to the receptors on the cell membrane, but they have to be acted upon in the nucleus. And so the cell needs to carry that information from the cell membrane to the nucleus in a way that the nucleus can then deconvolve or kind of sift through that information and make an action. So if the cell needs to decide to proliferate, to kill itself, to move, all those sorts of things require information from its surrounding area. And so in cancers, it turns out that dysfunction in various pathways is extremely common. And so, for example, about 60% of cancers or so have a mutation in one of the components of the epidermal growth factor receptor pathway. And what happens is that receptor or one of the components is basically always turned on. And so what happens is then that the cell gets continuous growth signal indicating that it should be proliferating. And of course, that's one of the things that contributes to the formation of cancer. And there's tremendous interest in finding small molecule drugs that will block those mutations and turn off that signal. And it turns out that when you do that, not only does the cell stop proliferating, but it often causes itself to die. And so this is an effective therapy in cancers, although in most epithelial cancers, it doesn't last very long. It happens that the cell becomes resistant. So I'm interested in this because it's just so common in the cancer world. And when I look at it, though, it turns out, at least to me, that the conceptual models that exist of these pathways is very schematic. And so these proteins have to move from the cell membrane to the nucleus, which is conventionally shown as a relatively short distance relative to the size of the proteins, but that's not really at scale. And it turns out that if you draw this to scale, it's about 1,000 protein diameters between the cell membrane and the nuclear membrane. And so that's not a distance that proteins can travel easily just by random walk or diffusion. And so this turns out to be a problem, a physical problem for movement of information that normal cells have to resolve. And then when we think about blocking that pathway in cancer cells, we need to take into account how these proteins move from the cell membrane to the nuclear membrane, how they interact with each other. So you get crosstalk, and probably within that are the mechanisms for resistance.
Yes, I was struck by that because it seemed in the models that people typically look at, it seemed very simple. And as you mentioned, it was just all words, description of how the proteins got inside. But when you think about it in the terms of the distance that they have to travel, it's a completely different way of thinking about things.
Yes, it tends to be something that cell biologists have kind of ignored. And I don't know why exactly, but it's a problem that I think we've not really been very aware of. And so it's a lot easier to do the biochemical experiments, really sort of just seeing how these interact with each other in a test tube and ignoring the physical reality of movement.
So I think you mentioned that some favorite mechanisms would be diffusion or microtubules pulling these proteins in, but you think that that's not adequate?
Almost everybody, when you ask them about this, has an idea of how it might happen, but those tend to be relatively ill thought out. So the most common one is diffusion, that simply these proteins move by random walk or diffusion from the cell membrane to the nucleus. Again, that would be fine if the distance was relatively small relative to the side of the protein, which is how these pathways are usually depicted in the textbooks. But 1,000 protein diameters is a very long distance. Some people think they flow along microtubules, and proteins that are recently synthesized can be delivered to locations by microtubules, but this would really require that they find their way into these tubules. The tubules aren't usually that long, And it really is a shuttling back and forth. And then the other thing that people talk about are microfilaments, and there's this idea that somehow they get grabbed, each protein gets grabbed by a microfilament and pulled to the nucleus. Again, when you start to sort that through and think, well, how practically can that happen, it doesn't really make sense.
So what is your suggestion?
Well, my thought is that there has to be some kind of internal structure that promotes movement. And I was struck by the fact that the way that that information is passed from protein to protein in these pathways is through phosphorylation. One protein then adds phosphate groups to amino acids in the next protein. And this is well known, and this is kind of the coin of the realm for information transfer. And all of the focus so far has been on the fact that these phosphates change the configuration of the protein, but they do that by adding negative charge. And so what interests me is that the protein itself becomes very negatively charged with this, and that maybe the cell uses that to cause movement. And so we postulated the idea that if you had an intracellular electric field that would tend to move proteins from the cell membrane to the nuclear membrane if they were negatively charged, that you could provide a mechanism that would then allow them to move very, very quickly. So we started with this idea that there would be an electric field generated by the nuclear membrane or someplace around the nuclear membrane that would draw these proteins toward the nucleus when they were phosphorylated. And so that was kind of our original idea. And then as time went on, we began to realize that there's really more to that than just the phosphorylation piece, because proteins have very specific and a wide range of what's called the isoelectric point. And what that means is that in the pH of the cell, which is usually between 7.2 and 7.4, some proteins have a very high isoelectric point, which means they're positively charged, and others are very negative. And what that means is that even under normal circumstances, the cell can use that to push the proteins in one direction or another. So for example, one protein that has a high isoelectric point will be positively charged throughout the cell and will then tend to be pushed by the electric field out toward the cell membrane, whereas something that's negatively charged will be located near the nuclear membrane. And so this actually provides the cells with an opportunity to really localize their proteins in very specific ways. And so I think adds another layer of organization to cells.
And would the mechanism of protein movement be a lot faster doing this than through the microtubules or microfilaments or diffusion?
Yes, we calculate that, in fact, a protein under these circumstances can move from the cell membrane to the nuclear membrane in less than 1 second. Very, very fast movement. And more than that, it even will get funneled directly toward a pore in the nuclear membrane, which is where it needs to go in order to get through to interact with the DNA.
Do you think you'll ever convince the people who favor the other explanations? Because I presume they come from a different background.
It is. I think that, as we sort of learned here, in some ways it's convincing the physical scientists about this and sort of working through how an electric field could be developed. As a non-physicist, I'm relying on working with biophysics people to sort of think through this. What's interesting is that the biologists, when I've presented it to them, have almost slapped their hand on their forehead and say, oh, you're right, we don't really know how this works. And that has been, I would say, in general, there's been some skepticism. There's always going to be some skepticism. But there's always been, I think, the recognition that this is addressing a real problem that's been ignored. So whether it's right or not, I think they reserve judgment, but the fact that there needs to be some understanding of this is sort of dawning on people now. So,
and how will this play into the cancer research field?
Well, because these pathways are typically always on, and so there's a constant steady movement of these messenger proteins from the cell membrane to the nuclear membrane, the dynamics of this is very, very different in cancer. And we don't know yet. We haven't done measurements yet on whether the electric field is different, and if it's different, is it different because these protein pathways are turned on, or do these protein pathways get turned on because the electric field is different. In other words, you might say, if the cell is going to die, if it doesn't get a constant stream of these messenger proteins stimulating the nucleus, which is the case, if you start to get dysfunction of the underlying electric field so that the movement of the proteins is no longer very efficient, does the cell have an opportunity to respond by upregulating the number of proteins that are being made, and does that contribute to the process of carcinogenesis? So, I mean, that's pure speculation, of course, but that's one of the things that we're thinking about. There is mitochondrial, we know that this is energy requiring, and there is the mitochondrial theory of aging, which is that energy production by the mitochondria steadily declines as you get older. And so, you you might say that this could be a result of senescence and could then be a factor, at least in some cancers. But of course, that's pure speculation. So,
and how could this ever be used for maybe preventing cancer or controlling cancer?
Well, we have found that changing the extracellular pH does alter the pathways that develop cancer. So we have an article being published in the Journal of Urology in the next few months where we've shown that if you take tramp mice get prostate cancer. If you put them on a sodium bicarbonate diet at a young age, they don't get cancer at all. And so we know that we can, by perturbing some of the physical properties of the cell and its surroundings, that we can alter the pathway to cancer. Now, whether this will be part of that or not, I don't really know. And that may be really too far afield to speculate. But
this is fundamental science, and we ought to know about it anyhow.
Well, I just enjoy it. I hate to say this, but I this is what 12 years of Catholic school will do to you. I had a little bit too much dogma from the school, and so I generally get a kick out of sort of poking fun at dogma. And so in some ways, I just enjoy doing it because I think this is just an area that people have taken for granted. So I get a kick out of just poking my head into it and, you know, mixing it up a little bit. So that's really all I wanted to do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.